So I'm not doing much of a review of last week, as I hope to make this just a very brief intro before we actually start doing some work together. But I did just want to revisit a few points from last week's talk. One is I gave various ways to think about what the topic of last week's talk was, which is the right intention of renunciation, which is one of those three right intentions that make up the second step or the second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, the Buddha's path of training. So there are eight factors. The second one is right intention. Within right intention, there are three right intentions that we are supposed to develop. The right intention of goodwill, of harmlessness, and then last week in today's topic, the right intention of renunciation. So other ways to think about the right intention of renunciation is as right motivation, right aspiration, or right resolve. So the purpose and aim in our life. My favorite definition of right intention or right resolve is Bhikkhu Bodhi's. I think I got this from his excellent book, The Noble Eightfold Path. The right intention of renunciation is inclining the mind away from its preoccupation with enjoyment of the outer world toward cultivation of an inner joy and happiness, not dependent on externals. I think that says it beautifully. Inclining the mind away from its preoccupation with enjoyment of the outer world toward cultivation of an inner joy and happiness, not dependent on externals, not dependent on the things out there in the world. I think that's very much related to that, the Buddha's urging us to sort of be islands unto ourselves, independent, not dependent on the things out there in the world. One of the points I tried to make last week was that we should never think of renunciation as deprivation or self-denial, but rather as Ajahn Jeff puts it, as a wise trade, trading the lesser momentary pleasures that we experience through that we can experience through the senses, but which bring no lasting happiness or fulfillment, for the superior happiness and lasting rewards of the spiritual life, what the Buddha calls the blessing of renunciation, a wise trade. And in the suttas, the discourses, the Buddhist scripture, the Buddha also refers to this wise resolve or right intention of renunciation as abandoning the ignoble quest in order to undertake the noble quest, which is making inner development the primary driving force in our lives rather than the pursuit of happiness in sensual pleasures. So, I also spoke last week about just what's involved in the kind of renunciation, abandoning of sensual pleasures that the Buddha urges us to undertake. And I described some of the practices of abstaining from sensual pleasures and restraining the senses when making contact with the things of the world. It demands a great deal of us, this practice, if we really are going to undertake it with our whole heart and, you know, devote our lives to it. So we can't just sort of be doing this practice grudgingly, sort of just going through the motions without really feeling a deep desire to do it within our hearts. As the Buddha put it in another discourse, our hearts must leap up at renunciation. Unless our intention or resolve for renunciation comes from a heart that's been profoundly stirred, our practice is going to be dry and half-hearted, and we are going to feel deprived. So Tenzin Palmo, a Western Buddhist nun in the Tibetan tradition, in a book by Vicky McKenzie called Cave in the Snow, puts it this way. In many Western Buddhist centers, something's going wrong. The Dharma isn't working as it should. I see people who have been sincerely studying and practicing Buddhism for years, and they still have the same hang-ups. So often there is a fundamental division between the practice and ourselves. The practice remains outside ourselves. It's very hard for Westerners to get out of our heads. We approach meditation from the brain only, but the practice has to come down into the heart, somewhere deep within us. Our hearts must leap up at renunciation. So I guess what I'm saying is like the other two right intentions of goodwill or metta, loving kindness, and harmlessness or compassion, which are often called two of the divine abodes, sort of beautiful divine emotions that we can cultivate. The right intention or right resolve of renunciation should also be thought of as an emotion. It's not just a thought in our minds, but it has to be lodged in our hearts. And so the question is, how do we rouse that emotion within ourselves? And the answer is with repeated practice until it becomes the inclination of the mind. Look at where renunciation is in the path. It's side by side with loving kindness and compassion. Those are the three right intentions. And so it just makes sense that they would all sort of be developed in a similar way. So how do we develop loving kindness, metta, and how do we develop compassion? Well, there are three ways that come to mind. One is with what are sometimes called metta phrases. I call them affirmations. We can simply remind ourselves of our sincere intention to wish all beings happiness. We repeat phrases like, may all beings be happy, may all beings be free from suffering. And we try to do so with a very sincere intention. We try to keep that intention in mind at all times and fortify it by repeating these phrases with genuine sincerity until they register deep within us and become, you know, a part of our being. So that's one way that we cultivate loving kindness and compassion. Another is with visualization. For instance, you can imagine someone dear to you who is in pain, and then let that image rouse a spontaneous feeling of compassion within you, and then you can extend that feeling in your heart to others until you radiate it in all directions towards all beings, so that sort of spark of compassion in the heart is roused by that visualization, that inner image of someone dear to you in pain. And all kinds of visualizations. If anyone's ever taken a retreat with Lee Brazington, you probably have at least half a dozen visualizations ready to use to rouse compassion and loving kindness. And the final way, and the way that we're going to work on today, is recollection or reflection or contemplation. Again, with respect to loving kindness and compassion, we use that by, for instance, recalling to ourselves that, like ourselves, all beings wish to be happy and free from suffering. We can reflect on the fact that everyone is someone's child, is someone's mother or father, someone's brother or sister, someone's, is dear to someone. And perhaps the only reason they're not dear to us is we simply haven't had the opportunity to get to know them. We can reflect on the fact that those difficult people who commit evil acts were often the victims of similar evil acts when they were children. We're just the product of our various influences. And sometimes that will help to allow you to feel warmer feelings towards someone who's especially challenging. So those are reflections or recollections. So again, three ways that we do try to arouse those feelings of goodwill and compassion in ourselves. Affirmations or metaphrases, visualization to spark that feeling in the heart and then extend it to others, or reflections, recollections, contemplations, if you will. So those are three ways that we develop and cultivate these feelings of goodwill and harmlessness. It just makes sense that we can use those same tools to help cultivate and rouse the third right intention, which is the right intention of renunciation. So how do we do that? We can use affirmations. For instance, when you take not the five precepts, but the eight precepts, for instance, sometimes you do that when you go on a retreat or stay at a monastery, we're not only reaffirming our commitment to harmlessness found in the five precepts, but we're also making a vow to abstain from and refrain from certain kinds of sensual pleasures. Abstain from any sexual activity, abstain from eating more than one meal, or abstain from eating after noon. Refrain from luxurious beds, from sitting on luxurious couches. Refrain from using various adornments and fine materials and fabrics to dress ourselves with. Those last three of the eight precepts all deal with restraint and abstaining from certain kinds of sensual pleasures. So by taking those eight precepts, sometimes daily in the morning or sometimes together as a group, we are essentially making an affirmation that we are going to practice this right intention of renunciation while we are on retreat or while we are at the monastery. Another sort of affirmation that Aya Kema mentions in one of her essays is just daily waking up and reaffirming our determination to spend this day not in, you know, making a better meal or finding the perfect pair of shoes, not in entertainment and diversion, but in spiritual progress. Just waking up in the morning, making that determination, strengthening our determination to spend our day in that way. That's very much just a simple affirmation of our intention for renunciation. We can use visualization to rouse this right resolve for renunciation. For instance, by using some of the very powerful similes in the suttas that the Buddha gives us for the dangers of sensual pleasures. I'll be mentioning some of those today when we do some of these exercises. So that's one way of using visualization to arouse that emotion within us, those powerful similes. And then finally, recollection and reflection. And there are countless instances in the discourses where the Buddha talks about the dangers of sensual pleasures in a way that's meant to stir us to change the way we look at sensual pleasures, to see not just the sweetness in them, but also the danger and the drawbacks and the unsatisfactory nature and flaws in sensual pleasures and sense desire. And also, there are numerous places where the Buddha talks about the rich fruits of a life of renunciation, so that we don't ever make that mistake of seeing it as deprivation and self-denial, but as something to be embraced and a source of great blessings. So we use, just as we cultivate loving kindness and compassion, we use these same tools of affirmation, repeated phrases, visualization and recollection and reflection to develop the third right intention of renunciation. So we're going to focus primarily on doing reflection and recollection. And I'm just going to read a couple of brief excerpts from the suttas that show how the Buddha himself used this tool in his own practice before his enlightenment. The first is the sutta that Jean introduced us to, the Tapusa Sutta. And in it, the Buddha says, "The thought occurred to me, what is the reason why my heart doesn't leap up at renunciation? Then the thought occurred to me, I haven't seen the drawback of sensual pleasures. I haven't pursued that theme. I haven't understood the reward of renunciation. I haven't familiarized myself with it. So at a later time, having seen the drawback of sensual pleasures, I pursued that theme. Having understood the reward of renunciation, I familiarized myself with it. And then my heart leaped up at renunciation, seeing it as peace." And the second passage I want to read is from a sutta that we often refer to, a very important one called the Discourse on Two Kinds of Thought. Whenever a thought of sensual desire arose in me, I understood thus. This thought of sensual desire has arisen in me. This leads to my own affliction, to others' affliction, and to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from the peace of Nibbana. Whenever a thought of renunciation arose in me, I understood thus. This thought of renunciation has arisen in me. This does not lead to my own affliction, or to others' affliction, or to the affliction of both. It aids wisdom, does not cause difficulties, and leads to the peace of Nibbana. So, by doing this kind of reflection and looking at the nature of these thoughts and seeing which were afflictions and which were not, which aided wisdom and which did not, and repeatedly reflecting on the dangers of sensual pleasures and sense desire and on the rewards and blessing of renunciation, the Buddha was able to rouse that right resolve of renunciation in his own heart before his enlightenment, which then stirred him to practice with absolute devotion and commitment. There was no sort of doubt about that he had chosen, doubt about whether or not he had chosen the right path. And there was no hankering for any of those sensual pleasures or worldly delights that he was leaving behind. He knew he was doing exactly what he needed to be doing, you know, the best of all possible things that he could be doing, because he had investigated this in his own mind. He didn't establish this resolve of renunciation through grim determination and willpower as much as through understanding. That's a key point, I think. It's understanding that really convinces us and turns that right resolve of renunciation not into just a simple thought, but a powerful emotion that can fuel our practice. That understanding is, of course, you know, understanding of the dangers of sensual pleasures, the fact that bound up with these what appear to be sweet delights of sensual pleasures is a great deal of suffering. And that's simply an understanding of the first noble truth of suffering. So Bhikkhu Bodhi puts it this way: the tool we use to free the mind from desire is not repression, but understanding. Real renunciation is not a matter of compelling ourselves to give up things still inwardly cherished, but of changing our perspective on them so that they no longer bind us. When we understand the nature of desire, when we investigate it closely with keen attention, desire falls away by itself without need for struggle. And sort of the other key passage in that sutta on the two kinds of thought, which follows the previous one, is whatever one frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of his mind. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of sensual desire, he has abandoned the thought of renunciation to cultivate the thought of sensual desire. And then his mind inclines to thoughts of sensual desire. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of renunciation, he has abandoned the thought of sensual desire to cultivate the thought of renunciation, and then his mind inclines to thoughts of renunciation. So whatever one frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of his mind. The key word there is frequently. Just as the cultivation of the right intentions of loving kindness and compassion are, for many people, a regular, almost daily practice, so too the cultivation of the right intention of renunciation has to become a regular practice. The goal is to alter our perception of sensual pleasures. That's quite a challenge. It's not going to be, you're not going to have this sudden epiphany and then it's all done. You have to have that epiphany again and again and again in order to rouse, a powerful enough emotion to really convince ourselves that we can turn away from the pursuit of sensual happiness and sensual pleasures and devote ourselves to the practice. So you can only do this by keeping that thought in mind, frequently thinking and pondering upon it long enough and often enough so that it fully registers and makes a deep, lasting impact. We need to sit with that thought of renunciation, that intention of renunciation. We need to reflect on the dangers of sensual pleasures and the blessing of renunciation again and again until it becomes a natural inclination of the mind, until it becomes second nature. Last quote, Bhikkhu Bodhi again. The importance of putting into practice the contemplations leading to the arising of these thoughts of renunciation, goodwill, and harmlessness cannot be overemphasized. We must frequently think and ponder upon them repeatedly and persistently, generating wholesome intentions moment by moment, gradually and steadily steering our mind away from the domination of desire and ill will. So, the rest of the day, we will do some of these reflections together. Good. Pass those around.
Can we each get one?
Yes, please. We'll look at some of these dangers and drawbacks, primarily from passages in the suttas. And the important thing I want to try and do here is see how we can take some of these teachings about the dangers, the unsatisfactory nature of sensual pleasures, and make them relevant to our own lives. I think that's the key for them to really resonate, is sort of get beyond the sort of archaic language, some of the outdated examples, and see what the spirit of that teaching is, and see how it's relevant to our own lives. So the goal then is to sort of demonstrate how this could be done in our own daily practice, so that our own hearts can leap up at renunciation. So I've divided this into two parts, the dangers and drawbacks of sensual pleasures and the rewards and blessings of renunciation. And then within the dangers and drawbacks, there are two parts. One where we reflect on how sensual pleasures are bound up with suffering for ourselves, and then how sensual pleasures and sensual desire can often lead to suffering for others. And some may find one or the other a more powerful motivation, may resonate more deeply. The idea here is to find one, two, three of these that really resonates for you, and try and make that a regular reflection that you use in your practice. So you'll also see here there's a heading Mass of Suffering Part 1 and Mass of Suffering Part 2. It's not a new movie franchise. It's, the Mass of Suffering refers to the discourse, the greater discourse on the Mass of Suffering, which is the 13th discourse in the middle length discourses. And it is basically a very thorough, extended reflection on how sensual pleasure, the pursuit of sensual pleasure, is bound up with a great mass of suffering. And what's wonderful about this particular sutta is that it's very practical. It can be made very relevant to a layperson or householder's life, and we'll see why that is. So under that first heading, the Mass of Suffering, Part 1, we have the pursuit of sensual pleasures requires struggle. It can lead one to commit unethical, immoral acts. It may result in failure and disappointment. Gratifying sensual desire may compromise our health. I actually inserted that one myself. It's not part of the original sutta. The desire for sensual pleasures brings anxiety, insecurity, and the pain of loss. So before we discuss that, let me just read briefly, because it goes into great detail. I won't bore you with all the detail. Some of that sutta. The Buddha says, on account of the craft by which a clansman, just sort of think of that as a lay person, makes a living, he has to face cold, he has to face heat. He is injured by contact with gadflies, mosquitoes, wind, sun, and creeping things. You know, so imagine someone, you know, toiling in the fields, or someone farming his own land, or just someone working outdoors. He risks death by hunger and thirst. He goes on to say, if no property comes to that person while he works and strives and makes an effort thus, he sorrows, grieves, and laments. He weeps, beating his breast, and becomes distraught, crying, my work is in vain, my effort is fruitless. So you can see how this particular reflection is looking at it's looking at specifically how the desire for sensual pleasures, in the sense of the desire for a certain way of life or standard of living, having a home, being able to support a family, and having to earn a living to have all of that. That's what the Buddha's focusing specifically on in this particular sutta. But we can extend the general ideas in this sutta to really the pursuit of any sensual pleasure, the pursuit of any sort of fulfillment in the world or enjoyment of worldly things. If property does come to that person while he works and strives and makes an effort thus, he experiences pain and grief in protecting it. How shall neither kings nor thieves make off with my property, nor fire burn it, nor water sweep it away, nor hateful airs make off with it? So this is the touch a raw nerve anywhere? So this is the brings anxiety, insecurity part. And then, of course, the pain of loss. You know, even if you toil, strive and toil, earn the money for that, say, that mortgage for that house, one day a flood just, you know, sweeps it all away. And he sorrows, grieves, and laments, beating his breast and becoming distraught, crying, "What I have, what I had, I have no longer." So again, I think what I want to do today is look at a sutta like that and see if we can make it relevant to our own lives. So that first part requires struggle. Sensual pleasures require struggle. You have to work in order to earn the money for a comfortable home, for beautiful things to fill it with, for a beautiful young wife, or a handsome young husband who wants to stay at home with the kids. You have to work to make this kind of life a reality. The physical discomfort, or the stress, the soul-crushing tedium, even the dangers that some people endure in order to pay for the mortgage on a comfortable home, the beautiful things they fill it with, the pleasures and amusements they enjoy, whatever vision of the good life they aspire to. The Buddha would consider all of that struggle to be a danger in the pursuit of sensual pleasures. It's like putting the sweetness of those things on one side, the pros, and putting all the stuff we'd rather not have to deal with, you know, the stress, the long commute, the endless hours in a cubicle, you know, whatever your job looks like. If you're one of the lucky ones who's totally fulfilled by it, you can ignore this. If you're one of those who, you know, doesn't so much live for their job, but, you know, does their job because it pays the bills, then maybe some of this resonates. But put all of that in the con column, and the Buddha would say, on balance, are those sensual pleasures that you're striving for worth worth all of this suffering? It's not too different from, if any of you have read the book, Your Money or Your Life. It's not too different from some of the reflections that they have you do in that book. So again, very practical stuff that the Buddha's having you think about here. So we're going to break up into small groups in a minute, but I thought maybe if anyone has any thoughts or a personal story that relates directly to this or some of the other kinds of suffering that the Buddha mentions in this great mass of suffering sutta, not just the struggle, but the suffering of failure and disappointment, the anxiety that we feel about the things we do have, our anxiety that we don't, about losing them, the struggle to secure them, ensure them, protect them from natural disasters, from greedy heirs.
Hateful heirs.
Hateful heirs. Any thoughts on any of this?
I kind of just want to maybe think out loud about something that has crossed my mind in the past as well as now when you've been speaking, and that's about the distinction between craving something and then just having kind of a preference towards something, where you know, perhaps you like chocolate, and so you're on a walk and you think, oh, I'm gonna go get some chocolate, and you go to a chocolate store or something, and they're, for some weird reason, they're all out of chocolate. Like, if you're craving it, then you're suffering. You're like, oh, they're out of chocolate.
I apologize. Can I just stop you there? I just want to make sure that this isn't a question as much as a way of sort of making these particular
I'm going to relate
categories.
Back to renunciation.
Okay.
So actually, I don't know if it'll have to do with the specific categories here, though.
So say that again?
I don't know if it'll have to do with, like, a specific thing on this sheet, though, actually. Mm-hmm. It'll just relate back to enunciation.
Just because of the fact that we don't have a great deal of time, my brief introduction took
a little longer
than I thought. I really want to sort of just stick with, you know, sort of ways that we can see how this particular sutta is relevant to our own lives.
Mm-hmm.
Just brief comments about anything that comes to mind. For instance, if I were to put myself out there and raise my hand, I would talk about how I have a PhD, which I spent many, many years and a tremendous amount of effort getting, which I'm not using, and I won't go into why, but that was certainly an example of struggle to attain a certain kind of life that I had envisioned. And the thought that, you know, where could that time and energy have taken me if I had applied it to the path rather than to this dead end, often fuels a little more devotion to the practice for me. So I
have two buts or pushbacks. And one is the difference between, which is very murky, the difference between pleasure and necessity. I mean, if our Klansman wants to eat, it seems he has to do something, because so far we're not giving everyone money, you know, or whatever. So I think that's a very, that is worthy of investigation and reflection, but I don't hear that in that sutta. Then the other thing, and it may be coming under suffering for others, but in a different way, is that Klansman is responsible for, well, one would guess, other people, and so his or her decisions affect others. And for householders, that seems really challenging.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I've decided to live a certain kind of life, and my entire family is now going to feel the effects of that. And so that, I thought about that one when you read the sutta.
So let me first state that this sutta clearly is sort of addressing an audience that might be thinking of ordination. That I think it's a way of life choice here.
Yes.
But again, there's still an awful lot in here that we need to make relevant to our own lives as householders, who perhaps don't have that option of taking the robes and living life as a monk or a nun. And so, you know, I think it's a question of degree. And again, it's very, very much like, you know, your money or your life, in that we have to ask ourselves, is this degree of luxury, and I use the word luxury very, you know, very loosely, is this degree of luxury worth all of the struggle and anxiety and insecurity that will be required? Or can I choose a much simpler life? Maybe work half time and still be able to, you know, make a go of it if I really radically simplify my life, and then use all that extra time. Not, and this is the key difference between your money or your life, or books like Voluntary Simplicity or Simple Abundance. Key difference is you don't use all that extra time to enjoy the finer pleasures of life, finer pleasures of life, like, you know, walks in the woods, you know, making meals, making bread by hand, or, you know, whatever that may be, undertaking a new hobby. You use it for spiritual practice. That would be the key difference here between the message in books like those and the message in this sutta. So I think it's a question of degree rather than all or nothing. And so when I look at this sutta, you know, to me it says how much the extra effort and struggle and anxiety that would be involved in, you know, achieving this standard of living, this lifestyle, is it worth it? So it's not a... Does that answer that question?
Yes, I think that approach
isn't very
clear
in
that
right.
The sutta, but I think that's the investigation.
But that's what I want, exactly what I want to do here.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of an individual question. I mean, this whole question of what's enough? What's enough?
Oh, completely. Completely individual.
Yeah.
What comes up for me is how is walking in the beautiful woods or some of the other examples you used necessarily not a spiritual practice? What's the difference?
That's an excellent question. And I will just quickly answer it, and then I really, rather than making this a Q&A, which I don't feel qualified to really undertake, want to continue with reflections. But it's a sensual pleasure in the sense that we are getting pleasure. At least when I think of walking in the woods, I think of the pleasure of feeling the breeze against my skin, the pleasure of listening to bird song, you know, the pleasure of the sun on my back. Those are all pleasures that we experience through the senses, so they are, in that sense, sensual pleasures. They would be subject to all of the dangers and drawbacks that we will be looking at from now. So just sort of keep that in mind. And see if any of those, you know, relate to some of these reflections that we'll continue with. So another way to reflect on the dangers and drawbacks of sensual pleasures is by looking at the nature of desire itself, the nature of sensual desire itself. And the first one I have here is: wanting is discontent. Bhikkhu Bodhi calls this the suffering of perceived lack. The wanting mind is by definition a discontented mind. Yearning for what we do not have makes us discontented with our present situation. When we get caught in sensual desire, we deny ourselves contentment in this moment for the hope of a future happiness. And we do this again and again and again. So sensual desire condemns us to a lifetime of discontent. So wanting is discontent. You can think of the fact that sensual desire is insatiable, is a cause of bondage. We are slaves to our desires. It's endlessly agitating and disturbing for the mind. So again, all of these are not so much meant to be facts as investigations. We look at these, we read suttas, maybe passages from great thinkers, and see how we can make them relevant to our own lives. Does this make sense to me? Does this apply to my life? Do I ever feel like I'm in bondage to my own desires and wants? Do I ever get it that, yeah, sensual desire is insatiable? It will never end. And am I okay with that? So these are all the sort of questions and investigations that we should be doing with these reflections. So maybe we'll try and break up into small groups for this section, and just sort of choose groups of three or four. And as you're doing that, I'm just going to be reading a little bit more to sort of seed your discussion about whether reflecting on the nature of desire can rouse a feeling of wanting to embrace a life of renunciation. So, just to clarify what I was suggesting you do, that section on the nature of desire, there are half a dozen ideas there regarding how looking at the nature of desire can show us the suffering bound up with sensual desire. The one that I just discussed, wanting is discontent, and sensual desire is by its very nature insatiable. Then there's pleasure is fleeting, it cannot be controlled or counted on. Sensual pleasures relative to spiritual pleasures, and we'll be discussing those later, are coarse and inferior. And the gratification of desire simply increases our lust and greed, which is leading us away from the goal of eradicating lust and greed in our hearts. So talk about, and maybe just do it the way we always do, one at a time, while the other two listen. Talk about whether any of these resonates in particular for you and why. So start with one, and I'll ring again when the next person can start. Okay, I would be much remiss if I didn't move on and look at some of the rewards and blessings of renunciation in our last few minutes. So there's a lot here, there was a lot I would like to have gotten to regarding the dangers of sensual pleasures. I don't know if we really got to a place where we could see that this is relevant enough to our lives to really start moving us towards renunciation. But I hope you sort of get a taste of what it's like to sort of do some of these reflections on the dangers of sensual pleasures. The other half of that then is also looking at renunciation and trying to see it as a life of rich blessings. And a few of the ways of doing that that I've written here that again primarily come from the suttas is seeing renunciation as a way of life that is rare, noble, leading somewhere worthy and fine, with rich fruits, a life of contentment, freedom, and the ease of simplicity. Someone who embraces renunciation, turning away from sensual pleasures and the pursuit of worldly enjoyments, becomes blameless, one of purity of conduct and character. We trade the lesser pleasures of the senses for the extraordinary exalted pleasures and joys of the higher mind. For example, the jhanas, if anyone has experienced those. And finally, it's a chance to know and see the deepest truths of our existence, to have some true wisdom. So we reflect on these. We take these in. We try to envision what such a life would be like, what it would be like to have a mind with these qualities, and see if that can inspire the right resolve of renunciation within us. So just for a few minutes among you, if you want to talk about maybe one, which one of these resonates most deeply with you and why. Person. It's time to bring this to an end.
What?